This is Wells Tech, a show that explores the intersection of technology and ministry. Wells Tech is a part of the Streams Media Network sponsored by Wells, the Wisconsin Evangelical Lutheran Synod. Your show hosts are Martin Spriggs and Sally Draper. Join the conversation at wellstech.wells.net. Wells Tech is back on the air with episode 454, recorded on Wednesday, July 20th, 2016. My name is Martin Spriggs, and this is a show we call Wells Tech because we talk about not just Wells technology, but technology and all kinds of ministry. And we're going to do it again this week, and helping me do that and joining me as usual, Sally Draper. Hi, Sally.
Hello, and welcome back to podcasting. Do you remember how to do this, Martin? It's been a while.
We recorded, pre-recorded a number of shows because first you were on vacation, out camping in the backwoods. No, you went to Colorado, didn't you? Did you camp there?
We did. We intended to camp, but our plans changed, so we camped in a nice hotel room and had a really good time. Went up to 12,000 feet in Rocky Mountain National Park. It was a beautiful place.
Oh, okay. We didn't camp. We went to very hot and sticky Florida for a week and a half. My mom and my sister lived down there, had a great time. Well, it was about 95, 96, 97 every day and probably about that much humidity. So it rained every afternoon, but it was fun. Good to see them and did a little family tech support while I was down there. You got to love the opportunities to do that when you can.
Yep, there's always something that needs attention, and quite often, unfortunately, in this day and age, it's malware that has creeped onto our friends and family's computers, and that's actually the topic for today's show, so very timely that you were doing that.
Yep, spent a lot of time trying to figure out why things weren't working and what things needed to be removed, and we're going to talk about some of the common sense ways to avoid stuff like that, but there are all kinds of tools that are out there that will help help keep your computing environment as safe as possible. We're in a summer series where we're taking a little lighter look at things, and we're in the month of July, and July's topic is security. We've talked about a few things already, like passwords, etc. And as you mentioned, Sally, we're going to spend a little more time talking about virus protection. This won't be necessarily what maybe a technology director would do, trying to protect the network, maybe the school kids. This is more, I think we're really going to focus more on kind of personal protection, things that you can do and maybe things that you can share with family members or staff members to keep their computing environment safe. Where should we start?
Well, I think, you know, a logical place to start is to just talk about some of the software that's available, because it should be to everyone kind of a given that they're running some type of software. I actually read one article that said we weren't even going to list that. We expect everyone to be running virus protection software of some type, but maybe everyone isn't. So starting with the big names in virus protection, a couple come to mind, including the one we use at the Synod, which is called Bitdefender. There's McAfee, Norton, Avast has it. Windows has Defender built right into Windows 10 and previous versions. So there's lots of options there to run something.
Yeah, if you are a Windows user, I think the operating system itself has come a long way to make it a little bit more, quite a bit more secure using some built-in tools, and Microsoft Defender is the current tool in Windows 8 and Windows 10. Maybe it was even back in Windows 7, although they had something called Security Essentials that I think you had to download. But right now it's built in, and the good news is it'll even nag you if you don't have something installed. It'll say, hey, you've got this, but you don't have it turned on, or you've got it turned off, and if you don't want to use this, make sure you get something, whether that's Norton or McAfee or whatever it is. You need something. So it's really critical, especially if you're on Windows, and I would say maybe even consider something on the Mac side too if you're a Mac user, to protect yourself against viruses. Some of these are free. Microsoft Defender comes right with the operating system. All of them, I think, have some kind of free version, or you can pay for it and get a little bit more expanded features like real-time protection when you surf the web and those kinds of things. You have to understand these things a little bit, because they will flag things that you're going to have to make some decisions on. The way they almost all work is that they quarantine items, and then you can make the decision whether that's a valid find and something that you want to remove, or something that you want to allow to have happen, because sometimes there are false positives as well.
Yeah, and I think one of the key components is that you actually run the software on a regular basis. You have it scanning your computer. So I think I personally know of people that have installed the software and feel like they're protected, but they're not regularly running it or scheduling it to be run perhaps overnight while you're sleeping or whatever it may be. So it's not just having the software, but actually making sure it's running on a regular basis. Typically, as it runs, it will also check for updates, because new viruses come out all the time. So you want to make sure that you're installing updates regularly as well.
Right. And yeah, leave that feature on where they are installing regularly in the background, and then you're safe, because there are new viruses that are coming along all the time. Those people that would like to have these things embedded on your system are constantly trying to get around these pieces of software. They've got them all installed. They're testing it on their own machines, trying to figure out whether what you have will stop what they're creating to get onto your machine. One thing we should probably talk about, Sally, is the fact that just because you have these tools does not mean you should throw caution to the wind and click away and not use just good old-fashioned common sense.
Yeah, definitely. In today's day and age, it's really easy to get scammed. I get emails regularly that appear to be coming from legitimate, like financial institutions or whatever it may be. They lift their logos and things like that. And unless you're really careful, it's easy to click, click, click and land somewhere where malware gets installed on your system or whatever it may be. Right. And it's like your defenses constantly have to be up. You can't relax about it usually. Another way that they might pass you off to a bad location is by using something like a URL shortener, where they hide a bad URL that might look suspicious to you normally in a shortened URL. And so you want to be careful of those things as well.
Yeah, there are a couple of ways to help you with that kind of thing. One is always, if you can tell, take a look at where that link is taking you. And it's simple as hovering over the link sometimes, and it will tell you that it's really not going to bankofamerica.com. It's going to, nairobi.exy.com. And, that's probably not where you want to go. If it's a URL shortener, I think there are tools, plugins for Chrome, I know, that will kind of expand those Bitly links or whatever kind of shortener they're using, so that with the tool in place, it'll allow you to kind of expand where exactly that shortener is going, so you can be sure that it's to a reputable institution or wherever it is that you know exactly where you're going to go once you click that link. So those are a couple of ways to just be careful. Another is just to be suspicious. When you're out there and something looks suspicious, if it looks a little bit shady, or there's often misspellings or things that are kind of giveaways that, hey, this is maybe not from the IRS, then you probably would do best to avoid it.
Yeah, definitely just keep your defenses up. But, as much as we say these things, I don't know about you, Martin, you probably never encountered malware on your computers, but it's easy to happen. And it has happened to me personally, and I've helped a lot of people that it's happened to as well. So I guess the next step would be what to do if you do get infected or you're suspicious of something. And certainly you can go back and run those virus protection softwares, and hopefully they would catch whatever's there and quarantine it, as you described. But there are other software available out there. One that comes to mind for me personally is SpyBot Search and Destroy, which is something you can download over the internet, and it's really good at detecting the malware and removing it, cleaning up the mess it's left behind.
Another one that we use here in the Senate office is called Super Anti-Spyware. It sounds like malware all by itself, but and it looks like it too. It's kind of a an old school, you know, they got the GIF, the flashing images, you know, the big red type. You know, it's not a pretty thing. Yeah, you've got it up there on the screen. And, you know, it kind of looks suspicious in and of itself, but trust me, it is actually a legit site. And there is a free edition. And you do have to kind of be careful when you install this, because they want you to click a button that will upgrade you. And they've got different kinds of editions, a professional edition, an educational or enterprise edition. And if you feel that it's useful, then go ahead and purchase it. It is a reputable software package. But even the free version, which is what we use here, does find some things that maybe your paid for products don't even find, because they keep it up to date. It'll prompt you once in a while to download updated definitions, and does a nice job. So you really actually can't have too many. So it's not a bad thing to have both SpyBot and Super Anti-Spyware installed, and run them with some frequency. I would maybe put it right on the calendar that maybe you do this at least once a month, if not more frequent. If your system seems to be acting inconsistently, maybe suspiciously, that's definitely the time to run these. And they will tax your system. You know, you'll hear maybe your fan start, and because they're going to look at all the files on your system and try and root those out. They'll also find things that are fairly harmless. So don't be totally, you know, freaked out when it does find, you know, 500 different quote-unquote threats. Some of those are just cookies that are sitting on your system that almost every site puts there. They'll flag all those, and you can actually get rid of those if you want and kind of get a clean start that way. These are nice little utilities to have, especially when you think things might be going a little south.
Yep. We also have some links to share with our listeners, Martin, of ways you can kind of check things out, and kind of going back to that idea of being suspicious of things. One that's probably primary and used by a lot of people is the website Snopes at Snopes.com, where they kind of debunk, they're kind of the myth busters of the internet, where they list out the kind of verbiage that comes along with some of these hoaxes and tell you if it's true or false, or if parts of it are true or whatever it may be. So always when you see these kind of things, you can go to Snopes and just search perhaps on a little bit of the text you receive or whatever it may be. And typically, they're going to have it listed there, and you're going to be able to tell that that they've debunked it, that it's not really true.
Yep, and that's good practice anyway. So if you've got something that you're a little suspicious about, or a URL that you're a little suspicious about, just do a quick search on Google, and usually you will find some information that will tell you, hey, this is legit or this is not. One thing, and since I was traveling and you were traveling, one thing that you want to maybe take advantage of are some VPN tools, virtual private network tools that will keep your connection safe. So if you're connected to an airport Wi-Fi or hotel Wi-Fi, something like that, usually those are not secure connections. So you may want to use a VPN of some sort. And we've talked about a number of these in the past. TunnelBear is one that I've recommended. OpenVPN is another. So you can install those on your system. Some of them even have phone versions. So if you're on a tablet or a phone, you can load this up and have a secure connection that you can be confident will keep your information safe, especially if you have to do some things that you definitely want to keep safe, like maybe connecting to your bank or credit card account, those kinds of things. Definitely consider some of these tools like TunnelBear, VPN. Those are probably good to have in your tool belt.
So I'm going to ask the obvious question that I should know the answer to, but I want to make sure I understand it correctly. So if I'm in a hotel room and I connect via the hotel's free Wi-Fi, then any data, let's say I go to that banking site and I type in my password and do whatever it is that I want to do on there, any data that's communicated is going through their pipes, so to speak. And someone could be monitoring and capturing that data. I mean, that's the danger.
Right. Could be somebody sitting in the parking lot, hotel parking lot, connected to that open Wi-Fi network and using sniffing tools or tools that are going to intercept that traffic. They could present you with false login pages. Mm-hmm. So they're capturing information that way. Or putting viruses again on your machine because you are essentially connected to the same network. Exactly right.
So you're opening up your machine to that. And by getting on a VPN, it's like you get off of the hotel's connection and onto this other connection. You're doing it through the hotel connection.
Right. So it's creating a little tunnel, you know, mm-hmm. in there that is quarantining off all the other traffic. So you're the only one on it, and you're going to a secure endpoint someplace else, and then you're going to the internet. So you're not trusting, you know, the hotel's Wi-Fi to keep you safe. Probably the best way to stay safe is to use your provider. So if you have a hotspot or whatever, so if you've got a Wi-Fi hotspot, or if you want to use your phone that way and it's connected to an LTE access point, that's a known connection. That's something that's safe that you should be able to connect securely to. So
good stuff.
Those are secure and password, you know, protected, of course. So that's that's probably a good suggestion. If you do a lot of traveling, that's probably the best way to do it. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you have to pay for data, and, you know, that could get expensive, so you wouldn't maybe want to stream movies and those kinds of things, but you do have that as an option. So, Sally, anything else we want to cover on this particular topic?
I am at a loss at this point. I think we have a lot of good links to share, so folks should make sure and check out our show notes website at wellstech.wells.net for those links. And we'd love to hear from you guys if you have other antivirus tips and tricks that you use or software that you recommend. Please do share.
Great. Appreciate that. All right. We should move on to our picks of the week. Sally.
And mine is right in line with what we were just talking about, because it just so happened that I came across an article from PC World, and I found it very interesting, if nothing else, just getting a little insight. The title of the article was What I Learned Playing Prey to Windows Scammers. So this particular author actually went along with some of the telephone scams that people called her with, and she actually recorded and logged some of the conversations and the different hoaxes and things that the scammers used to try to draw her in and get her to give them access to her computer, her credit card information, that kind of thing. And I thought it was really insightful just to, because, you know, typically I don't take those calls or I hang up on them, but at least having an idea of what kind of tricks they're playing on those telephone type scams could be really helpful to you. And one in particular that she mentioned kind of made me nervous, because she said one of the phone calls her child picked up, and they were willing to talk to the child and try to get the child to give them access to the computer and things like that. So the gist of most of the phone calls that she received were they were representing themselves as Microsoft and saying that they had detected some hoax or virus on your computer through your Microsoft licensing, and everything runs through this mega Microsoft monitoring system for everyone that has Windows installed or whatever, and that they were going to revoke your license if you didn't go along with what they were saying. And they kind of walk you through looking at some files on your computer, which are typical files where error logs might be, and, you know, typical kind of errors. But when you see it, you know, unsuspectingly, you think something really is wrong with my computer or whatever. So, and they were pretty persistent with her and insistent that she was going to, you know, be sorry if she mm-hmm. didn't act upon their request and things. So again, it's not a very long read, but I just found it really insightful to know what you're up against if you were to get any kind of calls like this or whatever, to be more aware of the type of telephone scams that may ultimately tie to folks getting access to your computer. So
raises a great point, Sally, because I think we probably don't do this enough, but having these meaningful conversations about security with friends and family members, if you're the tech support for them, it's really your responsibility to kind of educate them, send them articles once in a while like this, saying, hey, you want to be aware of this. This is happening because you would be surprised at how crafty and well done, so to speak, some of these scams are. And they can come not just from technology companies, but, you know, I've gotten calls from the quote-unquote the IRS saying, hey, you've got back taxes, you need to call us, and they'll take credit card information. And you know, very often, in fact, in almost every case, when you get those kinds of calls uninvited, uninitiated, they're probably somebody, you know, with a phishing scam, doing some social engineering, trying to get information out of you that they really shouldn't have. And, to have these conversations with your kids, have these conversations with your parents, grandparents, is really important. And, because people who are not into technology, maybe like you and I, aren't aware that these things are happening, and it really only needs to happen once, and some very bad things can happen. Mm-hmm. You know, identity theft is just one of them, but just some things that take so much energy to try and uncover from and recover from. So
yeah, she actually said basically what you just said in a paragraph. She says regarding her child being on the phone with these people, that was an eye-opening moment, and we immediately had a family meeting to explain these calls and emphasize that no one should be calling and asking us to do anything on the computer. We had the same conversation with the grandparents. So yeah, exactly what you're saying.
And many schools that have good internet safety kinds of courses, the kids will actually come home and, you know, educate the parents. But it's really important that if you have this kind of information, you know, make sure that you're having conversations around it. So
absolutely. Good.
Excellent, excellent, excellent. My pick is nothing to do with security. It has everything to do with your health. And this was an app that I was introduced to by my sister while I was on vacation. It is called StepBet. And it's an app for your Android phone or your iPhone. It is a program that will allow you to challenge yourself to take a prescribed number of steps. So you're using your fitness tracker in the process, and you essentially pay money. You pay $40 to join a challenge, and the challenge lasts 6 weeks. And what happens is you download the app, you pay the $40, and it calculates what your challenge will be based on your history of steps taken over the previous, you know, weeks or months. So it does an analysis. It presents you what kind of challenge this will be for you. And ultimately, over 6 weeks, if you achieve or are successful in reaching the challenge, you get your $40 back, plus the money from those people who didn't make the 6 week challenge. So they claim this is not betting, and this really is not gambling, because you have total control whether you make your steps or not. But the company skims about 20% off the top. It sounds shady, but and I can't say that I've been through the 6 weeks yet, so I can't totally vouch for it, but I'm making it my pick anyway, because essentially it kind of encourages you to hit your challenges. So for me, for instance, my challenge starts next week. I'm kind of in a test week. They do 1 week so you can try it out. But next week on Sunday, I'll have to hit, I believe it's 11,000 steps a day to get my 3 active days. I think they call them active days. And then you have two stretch days where you get, I think my challenge is about 14,000 steps. So this is based on my previous history. A little tip here, I was just walking around Disney for a couple days, so my history probably was a little inflated. So I think that's why my numbers are a little bit higher than maybe they would normally be. But I think hopefully I can make it. So if I hit my 5 days, my three active days and my two stretches, you get 2 days off. So, and you can do these in any order. So, you know, if you don't make it one day, you still have, if you still have days left in your week, you can still make it. And then if, again, over your 6 weeks, you've made every week, all 6 weeks, then you get your $40 back and then a cut of those people who didn't make it the 6 weeks. So my sister just finished her first 6 week challenge, and I think, I don't remember if she told me what she got back, but and she made it. So she, I think she said it was like $60 back or something like that. So she actually made money, and they claim this is in their rules and conditions that you actually can't lose your $40 even if everybody makes it. So they're guaranteed your $40 back if you make it. It works with iPhone's Apple Health app, Apple Watch, Fitbit for both Android and iPhone, Android Google Fit, and Android S Health, and that's on the Samsung devices. So it's pretty interesting. They're a company that also does Diet Bet, and that's a little bit different, where I think you've got to somehow prove by taking a picture, the scale, etc., that hey, you lost so much, so many pounds, etc. I didn't do that one, but this sounds really interesting to me, so I thought I'd give it a try and see if this would work. So far in my, let me check the app here quick, and it'll tell you actually how many people are in the challenge. So in my particular challenge, I have 450 people. And the total pot is $18,000. So that's kind of where we're going to start, and then they'll whittle away. And that kind of gives you a running total of how many days you made it, if you hit your stretch goal, if you hit your active days goal. And so it could get a little stressful, come Saturday or Sunday, if you haven't quite made it and you really got to hit your stretch goal on Saturday and Sunday, and maybe that's not a good day for you. So in the winter, this might be a little bit more challenging. So you've got to, we've got a treadmill at home. So Debbie's doing it too, my wife. So we may be fighting over the treadmill, on some of these Saturdays or Sundays, but I'm going to give it a shot for 6 weeks and we'll see what happens.
All right. Step. We'll be anxious to hear. Right.
Have you heard of this?
No, I haven't, but we'll mark our calendars and just follow along with you. I'm not putting my $40 up yet, but we'll see how you do.
All right. We'll see how it goes. So.
Sounds like fun.
All right, Sally. We do have some community feedback this week.
We do. First up, we got an email from Leslie Bergman, friend of the show, and she said, asking a question to keep your along with your podcast security theme for July. Why aren't the sites hosted by Final Web HTTPS when Final Web's own site is? Wells.net is not, but MLC's is. Please explain how or if the S of HTTPS impacts an average church website. So I wrote back and said, great question, and I'd like to learn it myself. So I think it spurred me on to find some articles and things about HTTPS, which I think probably people would have the impression that the S has to stands for secure. And that's accurate. When sites use HTTPS, the sites are encrypted, as I understand it. And Martin, you can jump in and correct me anytime you need to.
Go for it.
But they use a security certificate, a SSL certificate on those sites, and that's something you have to obtain for your website. But it's basically a copy of the website It's not the same site with the S added. It's another copy of the site and with the security certificate applied. And interestingly, in both the articles that I have to reference in the show notes, and really thorough and go through a lot of details about it, the number one reason that they talk about changing, besides the security enhancement for your users, is the fact that Google's search engine algorithms look for and give preference to HTTPS sites. So for search engine optimization, if your site is HTTPS, it's going to fall higher in the rankings than it would otherwise. So that I didn't know anything about. But like I said, I found a couple of articles. We'll link to them in the show notes that kind of walks through definitionally what it is and why you might do it and how you could do it. And I found it very interesting. The thing about making your site more secure is if you're gathering information over it. So if your site visitors are just coming to your site and not giving you any information through your website, it's not as much of a concern. Is that right, Martin?
Right. Yep.
So
that's exactly right. Although, again, the encouragement from the experts, so to speak, is, you know, to secure enable your site regardless, and then any traffic going back and forth, your browsing, etc., can be secure. So nobody can, you know, basically intercept that or create man in the middle type. Security Hijack. Challenges mm-hmm. where you're on a site that maybe you didn't know you were on and giving information or viewing information that, you know, whether it's, you know, calling a certain phone number, or, you know, again, more social engineering. So I think that's where everybody is headed. And she mentioned Final Web, and we should have that conversation with Final Web, and I'm sure they're thinking about that. She also mentioned Wells.net, you know, was not HTTPS, although it is. We just don't direct people there by default. So if you went to https://Wells.net, you would get to a secured Wells.net environment. But yeah, the important part, at least at this stage, is, you know, to secure that traffic that goes back and forth with forms. And I know even with Final Web, you're taking information over a connection if you're using their forms tool. So it is important to kind of begin thinking about that. And yeah, that's a great question, Leslie.
So yeah, stay tuned and maybe we'll have more things to report along those lines as time passes.
That's a great topic.
So
we did have a voicemail that was actually sent directly to my phone, but we'll share it here from former Lutheran Women's Missionary Society President Lynette Huppman. She left me a voicemail thanking us, and let's play that real quick here.
Hello, Martin. This is Lynette Huppman. I was the former president of the Lutheran Women's Missionary Society and served with Pastor Dave Witte. I just was calling to let you know how much I enjoy the technology things that you and Sally Draper do. It's just something that I don't get to often enough, but when I do get to it, I enjoy it very much. So I hope you're having a blessed day, and I just want to encourage you in your work for the kingdom and us kingdom workers. God bless. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Lynette, and we appreciate you sharing that information with us. And it's really our pleasure, and I know I speak for Sally, too, that it's an honor for us to do this. And, you know, we learn probably more than, you know, than we let on to through this whole process. This is really educational for us as well, and we're glad that it's made a difference for you and hopefully for the kingdom.
Absolutely. All right, we should move on with a few DIGO links that were shared in our DIGO Wells Tech group. A couple from Pastor Emil Burgess. One is to manualslive.com, and this is a place where you can go and find information manuals about different products. They say they have 1.6 million products represented and 2.1 million PDF manuals online for over 40,000 brands. So if you're looking for the original documentation on your vacuum cleaner or your ceiling fan or whatever it may be, it seems like Manuals Live, the ultimate manuals library, is a good place to check. They have a lot to offer, and I think worth checking out. So thanks for sharing.
That sounds awesome. Thanks for sharing that, Emil, because I can't even count how many times I've had to do a search, because very often you don't have the manual for whatever reason or don't know where you put it. And almost all of these are in PDF form someplace. And the neat thing about looking these up online in kind of PDF format or whatever is they're totally searchable. So rather than kind of paging through a paper manual that you might have or you might or might not be able to find, this is a great resource.
I know it's come in handy when we've moved into new houses and the stove was left behind or whatever, and you don't have the manual for it.
Where's this thing for the sump pump or water heater or the furnace?
So good stuff. Awesome. Thanks for that. Good definitely fun. One to add. All right. One more from Pastor Burgess. Whoops, that's not it. I must not have it open. Or maybe I have it in another tab. Here it is. How to make your iPhone or iPad read Kindle books to you. So this is from a blog called The Pastor's Week or pastorsweek.com. And he says at the end of his comments, Pastor Burgess says he hadn't heard of the blog until now, so he'll be following it. So might be one you want to follow as well. But basically they walk through how to, on an iPhone, turn on the accessibility options that will read to you with a two-finger swipe downward on your phone. And so those options are built into the settings of the iPhone. You just have to go in to general and then to accessibility and go into the speech options and turn that on. And then once it's on, you can go to a Kindle book or whatever it may be. And you have the ability right there in Kindle to slow down or speed it up because of the speech overlays and things that you can set up there. So Emil commented that Macs have the feature. In some Apple apps, Mail and Pages under the Edit Start Speaking option. And there's some Chrome extensions like Read and Write is one that he recommended that will read web pages to you. So toward the end of the article, this writer says it's good for lighter fare to listen to it this way. Maybe not something super heavy to listen to this way, or for whatever reason, that was kind of his preference. Do it with lighter books. Don't have a robot read the works of John Owen, he says to you. I don't know who John Owen is, but anyway. But a good tip and something that your smartphone can do for you if you're interested.
Cool. Thanks, Emil. Yeah.
So, and then one more, a quick mention from Jason Winjet, who tagged an article called 11 Reasons to Keep Screens Out of the Sanctuary. Sounds kind of strongly opinionated, perhaps, and maybe you don't agree, but if you don't agree in using that type of technology, maybe it's good to have an idea of what some of the challenges that people at least expect to encounter with screens in the sanctuary.
Right. It's always good to weigh both sides. I know a lot of our congregations are trying to figure this out, whether this is a positive thing or not. There are challenges certainly with architecture, and that's raised in the article. There are other reasons to and not to. Even on our hymnal committee, we're trying to figure out whether this is something that we address or not with some of the materials that we produce with the new hymnal that's coming up. So, you know, we've done some studies and many conversations around screens in worship and how to support them. Many congregations already have them, and I think are recognizing that, hey, there are some things that we need to deal with. So it's good to do as much reading as you can and challenge yourself for many different reasons to say, hey, is this a good way to go, or are there different ways to do it? So good find. Thanks, Jason, for submitting that.
For sure. We use a screen in our congregation, and I guess you don't realize what a blessing it is until it's kind of taken away. So we did worship not long ago. Our staff minister was on vacation who normally takes care of that. And without that, it was a big difference in our worship experience. We very much missed our screen. So, and you know, you, it's nice that it's there and I can always pick up the hymnal, but when it wasn't, I really, really noticed. I didn't expect that, but I did.
So. What is it that you like about it?
I like singing looking forward instead of looking down. Chin up. I really love to sing, and I love the fact that I can look up and praise God without having to stare downward at a book. So. Right.
Yep. And actually, my eyes appreciate the bigger text sometimes that I can see on a screen.
That
depending
too.
On the lighting in the sanctuary, you know, it can be an issue. So yeah, there are things, there are, you know, pluses and minuses on all sides. Too, so.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
Good. We should probably remind our listeners about the photo challenge because the end is near.
Yeah, 12 months of reminding our listeners about the photo challenge, and July is the last month. We're looking for pictures of summer outreach in Isaiah 52, verse 7. And I'm just going to say, we have some awesome pictures out in our photo library, 835 of them, all in the public domain, and that can be used by you and in any of your ministry settings. And summer abounds in the Wells Tech Photo Challenge Library. We got 4th of July. We've got summer barbecues. We got some beautiful feet on the mountains.
Awesome.
Those who bring good news. It's all here, and we would love to add your contributions. Look, there's even some Rocky Mountain High pictures. That one came from me. It was so gorgeous up there. So please do add your contributions to the photo library and help us close it up with a bang. We've had, I don't know, several new contributors just this month, Martin. I think probably because we had the article in Forward in Christ magazine, people have become more aware of it and are really appreciating the library that we've built out here that our listeners have built and contributed to out here. It's very, very special. So be part of it. You might win something in the process because the drawing is not far away where we'll be giving away some smartphone lenses to several lucky winners.
Very nice. I think that's going to about do it. Next week, we will return and continue our conversation about security and kind of zero in on security policies that you may want to be aware of, especially if you are responsible for the security for your environment, whether that be church or school or organization, depending on what you do and what you're trying to protect, there are policies you probably need in place for your own protection. And we're talking specifically about, you know, usually written policies, acceptable use policies, how to deal with password policies. If you offer public Wi-Fi, you maybe need a policy around how that should and shouldn't be used, mobile security. Even things like HIPAA and COPPA are things that you may need to be aware of depending on what your situation is. So tune in next week for a conversation about policies. We've got some of the sample policies on our Wells Tech Wiki. I'm sure we'll reference those, as well as a frank discussion on when you need a policy and what should be in it. So tune in next week for that. Sally went through the community feedback. You can be a part of that if you go to wellstech.wells.net. And there are all kinds of ways to get connected with us there. Across the top right of that screen on that webpage, there are all kinds of social media links, including Facebook, Twitter, Digo, Google+, Pinterest, Instagram. We have a Wells Tech listserv link there. You can leave some voicemail feedback. You can leave a written comment there, or you can just email us, wellstech@wells.net. Tell us about some of your virus experiences and how that might be helpful for others to hear. So any kind of feedback is always welcome. I want you to be a part of the show. Sally, thanks so much for your participation this week. And thanks to all of our listeners and viewers this week as well. We're glad you join us each and every week. Even if you only dip in once in a while, as Lynette talked about in her voicemail, that's fine. We're glad that you're here, and we welcome you to come back whenever you can. So take care, God's blessings, and see you next week. Bye-bye.